Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. What do you make of this moment we are in? 4 in 10 Republicans agree that if elected leaders will not protect the United States, the people must do it themselves, even if it requires violent actions. This is according to a January American Perspective survey. We are seeing a spike in violence and threats against politicians, election officials, healthcare workers, and school board members. 1 in 3 election officials say that they feel unsafe in their jobs. More than 1 in 6 plan to retire before the 2024 election, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. Last Tuesday, 5 members of the Proud Boys showed up at a school board meeting to, quote, stand watch in Wilmington, North Carolina. Back in February, Representative Peter Meyer, a freshman Republican from Michigan who voted to impeach Donald Trump, said he and some of his colleagues were buying body armor and altering their daily routines due to fear of violence. And in the next few hours, the United States House is expected to censure Arizona Republican Representative Paul Gosar for posting an edited video on social media showing him murdering Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The resolution would also remove Gosar from his posts on the House Oversight and Reform Committee and the House Committee on Natural Resources. He later deleted that tweet and issued a statement saying he does not condone violence. So far, most Republicans have been silent on the measure. Representative Paul Gosar is one of the most far-right members of Congress. The Hartford Current reports that Jim Arroyo, a leader of an Arizona chapter of the Oath Keepers, said Paul Gosar visited the chapter a few years ago. And when asked if the U.S. was headed for a civil war, the congressman said, "We're in it. We just haven't started shooting at each other yet." So how serious is all of this political violence and intimidation? The January 6th insurrection shows us what is possible. Many in the Republican Party are trying to downplay and erase what happened that day. So how can we counter this, and what are the root causes? Joining us are two guests. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is an historian and commentator on fascism, authoritarian leaders, and propaganda. She's professor of Italian and history at New York University and advisor to Protect Democracy. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is the author of 7 books, including her latest, Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. She also writes Lucid, a newsletter about abuses of power and how to counter them. You can find links to her work at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Ruth. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi. Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Lisa Graves, Executive Director and Editor-in-Chief of True North Research, a watchdog group that investigates and exposes those distorting U.S. democracy and public policy. True North's projects include CokeDocs.org. They publish hard-to-find documents about Charles Koch and his agenda all in one place. Previously, Lisa Graves served as senior legislative strategist for the ACLU on national security and testified as an expert before committees in both houses of Congress. Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you both. You know, it's a hard show to do because just finding, I mean, Ruth, looking for examples to put in the introduction, there are just so many. We weren't even sure which ones to grab, whether it's the Proud Boys showing up at a school board meeting or people who voted to impeach Trump buying body armor. I mean, the list is just so long.
Yeah. And so unfortunately, what we've seen, and we had this over the 4 years of Trump, is a shift in our political culture of the GOP, which became a far-right authoritarian party, and violence as a way of doing politics is where we are now, with incitements to violence, with the politics of threat. And all of this is this part of this radical shift. And then, of course, January 6th was a profoundly radicalizing event. And so now, you know, violence is a path to gaining power for many politicians in the GOP and their supporters.
What would you add, Lisa?
Well, I think what we're seeing, as Ruth said, is this radicalization of the Republican Party into a real reactionary authoritarian group. And as you point out, there are so many examples that it's actually frightening. And one of the things that is also frightening is how the FBI failed to adequately investigate the threats that were emerging, threats that were being reported to it about people planning to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th and at the invitation of President Trump to disrupt the counting of the votes in our election, to disrupt our democracy. And basically, some of them came armed, some of them came with plans, obviously, to invade the Capitol. And the goal, as we now see from so much reporting, was that Trump was trying every mechanism, the Justice Department, the Secretaries of State, the Pentagon, all these methods to try to disrupt and stop the vote. And so we are facing this new climate in America, a climate which we really have never seen as a country, in which violence has been tacitly condoned, even as some of the Republican members, have expressed dissent from that. The reality is that they've tried to stop an investigation of what happened on January 6th, including the role of the president and groups that surround the president in fomenting that insurrection, in addition to the president's own words, his incitement there on the Mall of the basically United States. And so one of the other things I would just flag is we're also seeing this effort by groups that are adjunct to the Republican Party, that are trying to aid the Republican Party, who are now trying to rebrand the hostility, the attacks, as now attacks on school boards, efforts to disrupt school board meetings and threaten school board members. And they're trying to rebrand as the party of parents.
Right. And we will talk about all of this throughout the show. But I want to ask you both about how big this is, because one thing I always wonder is, how many people are we talking about? Are we talking about an extreme fringe? Are we talking about millions of people? And Ruth, we found this really interesting study out of the University of Chicago. It's called the Project on Security and Threats. Mm-hmm. And their director, Robert Pape, says the insurrectionist movement is more mainstream, cross-party, and more complex than many people might like to think, which does not bode well for the 2022 midterms, or for that matter, the 2024 presidential election. And just to give you a couple numbers, they found that 47 million adults, nearly one in five in the U.S., agree with the statement that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump and Biden is an illegitimate president. Of those, 21 million say use of force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency. Of those, 7 million people own a gun. 3 million have served in the military. So what are your thoughts on these numbers? When we sit back and we wonder, how big is this? What is your answer to that question?
The reason there's so many people who are becoming radicalized today is that what Trump was able to do very, very skillfully, he is truly one of the most skillful propagandists of the 21st century. It might sound absurd to some people, but that's how I see it. And what he did through the leader cult was give all of these people a home. And every strand I'm about to cite of extremism was not, like Lisa was saying before, just the FBI didn't investigate. We had a kind of pact in this country to not investigate white extremism. So you have militias, you have what's called constitutional sheriffs, which I think are anarchists, are these sheriffs who refuse to respect or acknowledge federal law. And they were represented, all these groups were represented January 6th. And then you have a group that Pape studied of people who you could be called middle class, middle aged. They were extremists, all of them with arsenals, who did not have an affiliation to radical groups, but they showed up at January 6th. And January 6th was a further radicalizing event because it brought all these people together. And then you have all the extremists. So if you take all these people together, plus citizens who own arms and have been radicalized by disinformation, which has a huge role to play here, You have a considerable number of people. And one of the big themes, and unfortunately, my book Strongmen, it's the first book to put Trump in historical perspective of 100 years. I start with fascism, mostly right-wing authoritarianism, go up to Trump. And in every case, when you're trying to create a climate propitious to authoritarianism, you have to get people to see violence in a different light. You have to get them to see it as necessary, as righteous, as even moral. And so you have to have a cause. We're going to save the nation. We're going to save freedom. We're going to save the nation from, you know, slot in migrants, all kinds of enemy peoples. So that's what's been going on in the last years. And so many people have been swept up in this like kind of tidal wave of extremism, and that, and because Trump was so able at signaling to all these people and giving them a home.
Well, and to add to that, to drill down to look at what some of these people believe, Lisa, according to this report, when you drill down to the 21 million who say that force is justified to restore Trump, 63% agree that, quote, African-American people or Hispanic people will eventually have more rights than whites. 54% agree that a, quote, secret group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles is ruling the U.S. government, which is a key belief in the QAnon movement. So how would you answer that question, Lisa? How big are these threats?
Well, I haven't studied that particular survey, you know, that extrapolates as surveys do from a sample to the broader population. But I would say that the polling I've seen that is of a similar nature, which is that so many of the Republicans, which, you know, would have been considered, I suppose, mainstream a few years ago, have bought into the lie, which has been called the big lie, that President Trump actually won and that the election was stolen. And, you know, the fact that so many Republicans, such a high percentage of the Republican Party, accepts that as true, despite just a mountain of evidence that it is, in fact, false, is really astonishing. And that does mean that some of these fringe views and this sort of fringe notion has sort of jumped from the fringe into the dominant position within the Republican Party membership. And as Ruth said, you know, that belief, in essence, is a necessary precondition to enable or embolden violence, because it presents the people who are buying into it as being on the right side of a cause, and the cause that they claim is the defense of our democracy, when in fact it's the opposite. But in defense of that cause, then people feel some people will feel emboldened to take action in response to that cause and violent action. And as the number of surveys point out, that population, the people who believe this lie, includes some heavily armed individuals. And as we saw on January 6th, people willing to attack police officers, willing to attack the Capitol Police, willing to try to bust through doors and windows to advance that cause. And then you have someone like Donald Trump, who then calls Ashley Babbitt, who was killed while she was trying to fling herself into the House chamber where members of the House of Representatives were gathered and talking about the vote. As police officers, you know, were there, as law enforcement was trying to protect the chamber, protect the citadel of our democracy, you have someone like Trump calling her a martyr. And so, you know, that then adds to this idea of license, that someone who does engage in violence, that does attack the foundations of our government, will be hailed as a hero if they die in the process, which sends all the wrong messages. And the other thing I would just say is it isn't just the big lie. It's actually a really lucrative lie. It's perhaps the most lucrative lie told these most recent years, where you have a Republican Party now that is devoted to that lie, is fundraising constantly on a daily basis on that lie. And you have a number of groups that surround Trump, that aid Trump in numerous ways that are also raising huge money on that lie. And you also have a national television network, Fox, which has been devoted in many ways to advancing that lie, certainly through the broadcasts of Tucker Carlson and others. And I think in that way, what we have is sort of a political model, a media model that is in some ways consistent with the reporting about Facebook, which was that the Facebook algorithm was gamed to give more points for outrage than for likes, basically more points for anger than for likes, and that that helped generate more traffic, more business for Facebook. In this case, you have a big lie, a really damaging, terrible, and false lie about the election being told by Trump and all the senators and members of Congress and right-wing groups abetting him. And that's raising the heat, raising the temperature, raising the anger level, and making putting us really at DEFCON 2 or perhaps even closer in terms of where are the health of our democracy in the face of this threat, threatened violence, which we've seen, you know, basically brought out into reality. Bombs that were placed near the Capitol on January 6th. You have had assassination threats and plots against governors and other elected officials, including the first woman to be the Speaker of the House of Delegates in Virginia, Brad Raffensperger, and others. And so you have this sort of sense of license that these politicians, some of these politicians, are promoting with their fans as a way to maximize their outrage, maximize the fundraising, and I think maximize.
Oh, did we just lose Lisa? Lisa,
oh,
are you sorry?
I stopped. That was the end of my sentence. Sorry about
that. Okay. No,
that's
fine. That is Lisa Graves, Executive Director and Editor-in-Chief of True North Research. This is a watchdog group that investigates and exposes those distorting U.S. democracy. They've got a really important website, kochdocs.org, publishing documents about Charles Koch and his agenda. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is an historian, professor of Italian and history at New York University. She's the author of many books, including her latest, Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. She also writes Lucid, a newsletter about abuses of power and how to counter them. If you'd like to join us, what do you make of this moment we're in? How do you think we should counter all of this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Ruth, you pointed out in a recent Washington Post op-ed that the participants in the January coup attempt included 57 local and state Republican officials and at least 52 active and retired military law enforcement and government personnel. What really strikes you about what else we're learning? I mean, you had that Washington Post really lengthy investigation about January 6th. Frontline has a documentary. HBO has a documentary. It seems like every month we're just learning more information about what really happened and who attended.
Yeah, it's not surprising that we're learning way more, we're learning that the scope of this and the planning and the funding was way more extensive. And I remember deciding who to put in my book, and a third of the book ended up being about coups. And I thought, oh, well, this might not be very interesting for the American audience to read about all these military coups, but it's proved to be absolutely crucial. And one of the things that you learn from the history of coups is they're sudden, obviously, that's the whole point of them, but there are months or years of planning behind them, and many types of elites have to be involved as well as grassroots extremists. And the reason is, it's not enough to have the coup, you have to know that the coup is going to be accepted, because it's no good to have a coup if then the elites and the people, the media elites, financial elites, all those people, if they are not backing it, it's not going to go anywhere. So that's what's been going on and I've got my eye very carefully on the military situation. And you mentioned that, you know, there were dozens of active and retired military and law enforcement. And I'm very concerned about that because when things start happening, it's very important what the military and the police and other bodies do. And in fact, the first thing that Trump was trying to do, helped by General Flynn, who's an extremely dangerous individual, was to try and have martial law declared. So he actually, from November to January, actually did stuff that took from all the eras of the authoritarian history. And then the military wouldn't play because Joint Chiefs of Staff General Milley is committed to democracy. So he had to do other things, and he tried to manipulate the elections, and none of it worked. And so he had to actually, I see January 6th, he had to put together a kind of bespoke or custom army of thugs. And that's what we talked before about all these different kinds of people who were there. But these were backed by big money, by dark money. And that's because you had to make sure the coup was accepted. So this is a very interesting case in the history of coups because the coup failed, right? It didn't work. You know, it's amazing that we depended on Mike Pence to kind of do the right thing for one moment in his life, but it didn't work. And yet it was fully accepted. They, on January 7th, when the GOP didn't throw away Trump, who they could have seen him as toxic and discarded him, instead they accepted it, the double down and the big lie is the justification, blah, blah, blah. And so the coup methods and the coup mentality are now in the DNA of the GOP. So that's a very interesting case in the history of coups. So this is why people are calling this a trial run. That, you know, there all this violence that's percolating could come together for some other action.
To your point about military, we have some data from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The percentage of all domestic terrorist incidents where active duty military personnel were involved rose to 6.4% in 2020, up from 1.5% in 2019. What does that tell you, Ruth? And how should we discuss this in this country?
Well, this is a longstanding problem that there are extremists, white supremacists, extremists, other kinds of extremists in the military. And now it's as usual, you know, they're figuring out a bit too late that they didn't do anything about this. And this was they chose not to do anything. And so, you know, the defense secretary after January 6th had a kind of stand down where they were going to assess and get the, you know, data. But that takes a long time. And many people famously don't answer. They don't want to identify themselves because a lot of conspiracy, the conspiratorial conditions needed for a coup depend on not declaring yourself. It's like a secret society of sorts. So it's not, I think the only thing is that you have to expel these people from the military and you have to expel them from law enforcement and you have to expel Gosar from Congress and all of these extremists, all of these lawless thugs. If you don't expel them and prosecute them, then everybody else who shares their sentence is watching. And if nothing happens, that's a green light to them.
Lisa, what would you add?
Well, I just want to echo what Ruth said. I mean, the fact that we had someone of such courage, like General Milley, willing to stand up was essential for helping to protect our nation from what was unfolding on January 6th. And I'm not sure that people saw at the time with so much happening, but the Republican governor of Maryland was actually on the phone, and the director of National Guard for the state of Maryland was on the phone with the Pentagon trying to get them to allow the National Guard to go aid the Capitol in response to calls from the House leadership that they were, that the Capitol was under assault. And more than an hour passed where the Pentagon was not responding, was not permitting the governor of Maryland to have those troops come to the defense of our members of Congress. And that and so many other things that happened that day are why we need this January 6th commission, why we need those subpoenas, why we need the courts to enforce those subpoenas to get to the bottom of this, because this is something where, even though it was not, it did not result in as many lives lost as September 11th, it is, in fact, a major assault on our democracy from within. And our Constitution, the people who take an oath to defend our Constitution are supposed to take an oath to defend it from both foreign and domestic enemies. And I think what we've seen unfold here around January 6th and beyond is domestic enemies who were determined to subvert an election, a certified election, election that was certified to be, well-conducted, fair, not stolen, not fraudulent, but to overturn that election. A central component of living in democracy is having our elections honored. And there were only a handful of people in key positions, like General Milley, who were able to stop what was unfolding from coming to fruition. And I think it's quite clear from all the signs we've seen, all the messages that have come forward, and that, as Ruth said, there was, you know, in essence, an effort to get martial law, or at least a consideration of martial law, determined. I personally think that if a member of Congress had lost their life that day, that Trump would have tried to declare martial law, would try to have suspended the certification of that election, and tried to seek a redo and enter America into a new era where we don't have a properly elected president, and where elections are at the whim of someone like Trump, who claimed that he should serve, you know, perhaps three terms, even though the Constitution only allows two terms. Someone who, as Trump has suggested, and Trump's allies like the MyPillow guy have suggested, that there's going to be some event that somehow restores him to his supposedly rightful role as president, as if he's some sort of king or Caesar. And so, it's hard to even believe that we're talking about this in the year 2022, that we are facing this ongoing threat to our democracy. But that's why it's so vital that Trump and people like Roger Stone, other groups that were involved in helping to foment this insurrection, are held fully accountable for their actions against our democracy.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're talking about what we should make of this moment we're in, at a time when 4 in 10 Republicans agree that if elected, leaders will not protect the country. The people must do it themselves, even if it requires violent actions. This is according to an American Perspectives survey. Lisa Graves is executive director and editor-in-chief of True North Research. One of their projects is CokeDocs.org, which publishes hard-to-find documents about Charles Koch and his agenda all in one place. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is an historian, author of many books, including her latest, Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. She also writes Lucid, a newsletter about abuses of power and how to counter them. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, as a follow-up to today's show, we will discuss the rise of disinformation and how to counter the powerful right-wing media machine, from Fox, Newsmax, white supremacist podcasts and YouTube shows. Media manipulation has really exploded. And so we're going to talk about what we're really facing and then how to counter it. Today, we're talking about what we should make of this moment we're in. We're talking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, an historian, author of Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. Lisa Graves is executive director and editor-in-chief of True North Research. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm really glad to hear this program, in a way, because I think this issue has been neglected by the media. I'm not sure. Well, first of all, we've got a year to the election, and I think between now and 2022, it's going to be very scary as it even gets closer to 2022. I'm surprised that the federal government, actually, under the Democrats, haven't even gone further in terms of trying to root this out. in terms of not only the military, but the police. And that scares me a lot, because watching these trials that are going on right now, it's surprising that the federal government hasn't taken much more aggressive role in dealing with this, both because of the way Rittenhouse dealt with this, what happened in Charlottesville, and this trial in Georgia. So I'm very frightened, if you will, about what's going to happen leading up to 2022. And lastly, if the Republicans should take back the House and or the Senate, et cetera, I think we're going to be in bad shape going forward. So I think that this is much more widespread, but those entities that have power and the guns are the people that I think are really scary, and that the government should really be focusing on that and doing more than they are. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Greg. That was also on our list, because Republicans are poised to flip House seats as gerrymandered maps emerge. We're getting news just in the last week from Mother Jones' Ari Berman. Massive gerrymandering is taking place in Ohio, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Georgia. And this gerrymandering is securing seats for Republicans, even though Democrats will get more votes. But first, Lisa, what are your thoughts on Greg's first part of the question? A lot of people are saying that the Democrats are just still so tied to this idea of bipartisan politics, and we are way past that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what we're seeing with the House leadership is that they believe that this issue obviously transcends and should transcend politics, which is why they've moved forward with the January 6th commission over the objections of Republicans. It's not, you know, it is a bipartisan commission because you have representatives like Representative Cheney on that commission, who was, you know, as everyone knows, stripped of her House leadership role because she dared to speak the truth about what happened on January 6th, and is committed to working with this bipartisan commission to investigate it. But that's a very narrow component of bipartisanship, because the Republicans have signaled at every juncture, in essence, every committee hearing, their willingness to advance this big lie. As a party, their leadership, Jim Jordan and others, have been at the forefront of advancing this big lie. People like Senator Josh Hawley and others have continued to perpetuate the big lie of lucrative lie of Donald Trump. And so you have a Republican Party that is not interested in bipartisanship, and they're not interested in bipartisanship even for other issues, economic issues, for helping to help our economy grow through the Build Back Better plan and more. I don't think it's necessarily a fair criticism to say the Democrats aren't interested in pursuing this. They actively pursued the impeachment of Donald Trump, tried him in the United States Senate, and of course, with the Republicans there acting in almost unison, they held off yet another impeachment of Trump for his high crimes and misconduct. And you also have this ongoing January 6th investigation. I would say one of the things that I guess I agree with Greg about is that the trials and the plea agreements have been disappointing. I think that there should have been more charges brought, more people who were involved should be charged, and the penalties should be stiffer for what happened on January 6th and in these other incidents. At the same time, we have a jury system in the United States which historically has been used to the advantage of white people in crimes in which black Americans are charged, or in which blacks are victims. And so we also face a criminal justice system that continues to have some significant challenges in terms of its ability to hold people accountable, white supremacists accountable. For most of our history, the jury system utterly failed to hold white supremacist Klansmen and others accountable. And so we have a lot of work to do to reform our criminal justice system. But that's in addition to the fact that I think the Justice Department should be more aggressive in insisting on greater penalties for the people who have been found to have been involved in the January 6th insurrection. And they should be punished to the full extent of the law.
Ruth, what are your thoughts about how the Democrats are handling all of this?
Yeah, I share Greg's frustration. And one thing that happens is the pace of democratic justice is frustratingly slow because, you know, it's like when Donald Trump said to Xi Jinping, wow, we should just be able to execute people immediately. Well, that's not how it works in democracy. So there is this slow pace of justice, and many people rightly feel that we don't have that kind of time. And you also see something happening when someone very lawless has been in power. Those who come after him can be overly cautious, maybe because they're under constant threat. We can be probably sure that, you know, Merrick Garland is constantly being threatened and attempts to blackmail him. That's how Trump rolls. And also to not have appearance of bias. But this is this backfires, because unless you prosecute people, their popularity doesn't go away, their empowerment doesn't go away. And what has happened is there's a culture of lawlessness, and people feel very empowered, including Gosar, who feels it's okay to, you know, tweet, have a video made. He had that video made. That's what's like so striking, in which he kills AOC. And that seems to be an okay thing to do. And he expects to get away with it. And getting away with it is the essence of authoritarianism. So we have a bit of asymmetry where there's the plodding pace of democratic justice as meted out by Merrick Garland, and then there's the growing emergency of our democracy.
Before we get to our next caller, I just wanted to ask you both about what we're facing in the next 2 years. The New York Times had a piece in June called How Republican States Are Expanding Their Power Over Elections. In Georgia, Republicans removed Democrats of color from local boards. In Arkansas, they stripped election control from county authorities, and they're expanding their election power in many other states. I mentioned the tweets from Mother Jones' Ari Berman just over the last week. The Ohio GOP congressional map gives Republicans 86% of seats in a state Trump won with 53% of the vote. North Carolina, it gives Republicans 71 to 78% of House seats. North Carolina is 40% non-white. In Wisconsin, it gives Republicans 75% of U.S. House seats. I mean, I can go on. And this is already done. And so Mother Jones' Ari Berman says, you know, we need to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But again, it just failed 50 to 49. Only one Republican supported it. Ruth, I was really struck by an interview you did with Dr. Brian Kloss, who's author of Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. He says, I think the window is closing to fix all of this. If we don't fix it in the next 2 to 4 years, I don't think it's going to get fixed. I mean, that just makes you take a really deep breath. Do you agree with him? And what can people do in the next 2 to 4 years?
So I do agree. I also think that it's very important not to be fatalistic and give up. The interview with Brian Kloss is in my newsletter, Lucid, and I just published yesterday an essay called Waiting for the Apocalypse, and which argues that we shouldn't get into this mode of waiting for the apocalypse because it takes away our agency. Because mm-hmm. there are things that we can do. It's very important. There are people who say, oh, you know, with voter suppression, it's useless to work for voter turnout. But that is just giving up. So I believe that there are things to be done. There were so many millions of people who never voted, who don't vote. And part of this is education in the stakes of what we face. And it's hard to convince people to put democracy protection and mobilization into their daily lives. Like, we work out, we go to the store, we have to be doing this every day as part of our lives, because otherwise what we have taken for granted for so many years will be taken away. And the other part of the education is many people, partly because it's scary, it's very hard to grasp the magnitude of the criminality of Trump. And it's not all about Trump, of course, but this is someone who is allied with the mafias of several countries, who is another interview I did with a kleptocracy specialist. He's on the supply side of the kleptocracy chain. He, through his real estate, he launders money for people. He's immersed in these flows of criminality at a, on a global scale. And this is who was our president. So why does this matter? He shifted the culture to give permission for people to be their worst selves. And so everything that was already being done through the whole past with the Jim Crow laws and voter suppression, it's now souped up, it's accelerated. And that's what January 6th did. It broke all these taboos. Mm. And so this is where, yes, things are accelerating, but we shouldn't think there's nothing for us to do, so we just sit back and wait, because then we're that's not a good attitude to have.
Well, I'll get you to respond in a minute, Lisa, but one more follow-up for you, Ruth. You know, on a show like this, where, frankly, we'd rather be talking about how to deal with inequality and poverty and bring on people who are, you know, helping others in their communities, I mean, a lot of people don't want to go here because it is pretty dark. But what would you say to that?
It is dark. And there's a reason I ended my book with a chapter on the resistance. Hmm. And the way that people throughout history in the bleakest of moments have found a way to band together, to talk about love, to talk about solidarity, and that even when you get into a bad situation like a authoritarian rule, people get out of it through regaining trust in themselves, trusting civic values. And we are not there yet. We have a chance to reverse this. And I also think it's very important to remember that we just had one of the largest, or if the perhaps the largest social mobilization movement in American history, Black Lives Matter, in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the momentum for that carried over to getting rid of Donald Trump. We voted, and Biden got more votes than any American president ever got. So the energy is there. The people are there. And so it is bleak. And the more we know about it, believe me, I get scared all the time, because I know so much about this stuff and I know how bad people can be. But I also retain optimism and faith in humanity.
Lisa, what would you add? What should we do about this? How can we counter this?
Well, there's no doubt that this is an anti-democratic, anti-majority rule effort by the Republican Party in Ohio, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. I was going to say that there's no doubt that we are seeing this effort to impose minority rule in a democracy that's supposed to be defined as majority rule. And that's what those statistics that you mentioned from Ari Berman and others note in Ohio, North Carolina, and Wisconsin, which is this effort to basically have minority rule in those states. And, you know, that's not just an outlier, as you point out. It's actually part of a national strategy. It's been spearheaded by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. I did a lot of work exposing ALEC and alecexposed.org and other work. ALEC has lifted up the work of Cleta Mitchell, one of the lawyers who aided Donald Trump in advancing the big lie and continues to advance that big lie. She helped work with ALEC legislators in the states to try to advance these strategies to redraw the maps in these really distorting ways, along with others who she's partied with, who have worked supposedly protecting election integrity, which is the term that the right-wing Republicans use to try to mask this effort to suppress the vote. You also have these right-wing dark money-funded groups like the Independent Women's Forum that have, you know, worked to oppose the John Lewis Act in Congress, that have attacked it and other measures to try to restore voting rights in our democracy. That vote was very close, and there could be another vote, and I think there needs to be continuing pressure. I guess the solace I take in some ways is, as Ruth said, there was a tremendous turnout in the 2020 election to turn Trump out of office. And that turnout occurred in the most dire of circumstances in terms of the pandemic, with, you know, now nearly 750,000 Americans who have died from that contagious disease, and more that are probably uncounted because of the way the counts work. But you had, you know, people determined to vote despite this pandemic. And in that sense, the people who favor, having a real and functioning democracy outnumber those who have bought into these lies. But there's a long road ahead. There's a year between now and the next election. And there's a lot of organizing that will need to happen to try to repel authoritarian forces and members and people who support members who are embracing such authoritarian activity, like the member of Congress that Ruth mentioned, who's hopefully subject to sanction imminently. And I think the other thing we've seen in Ohio, for example, in Georgia, is that when people recognize that there are powerful politicians and dark money forces trying to make it harder for them to vote, mm-hmm. in many people that stirs their determination to vote no matter what, to stay in the line no matter what, to get more friends out to vote no matter what. And so these sorts of activities, this voter suppression, these totally distorting maps, they can have a counter effect if people organize to be a counter effect to them, to be a counter wave to these anti-democratic, anti-democracy measures, small d, democracy and democratic. And so I remain hopeful that there's plenty of time for people to organize, come together, and resist this effort to turn our democracy into a minority rule country, and to install people in office who have zero respect for the actual rule of law and zero desire to be actual stewards of a healthy and functioning democracy.
And just to remind listeners, Joe Biden got 80 million votes. Donald Trump got 74 million, and 84 million people did not vote in the 2020 presidential election. Let's take a couple more calls. Let's go to Ed in San Francisco. Hi, Ed. Thank you for holding.
Oh, hi. Excellent show. I like the book Strong Man, by the way. Excellent book. I do have a question. It was my impression at a certain point before they marched on the White House, Trump gave a speech, and he told the people to go up there, and he said, "I'll go up there with you." And of course, he didn't, which means he's really not a strong man. It means he's a coward. It was my impression that if he had gone up there leading the crowd, that he might well have overthrown the government. Do you think that's correct?
Ruth, what are your thoughts?
I think I have a line somewhere in Strongman that says that everybody around the strongman, all his fixers and enablers, they go to jail, but he never does. And Trump and Bannon and Flynn were far too smart to actually be. Trump was, of course, at the rally telling people he loved them and the journey's just beginning. But then, of course, he was safely away and watched it on television, and which is, of course, the most cynical thing. But that's what he wants. He used all these people in January 6th. The strongman philosophy is use and discard. And that's why they turn on people. Like the fact that Trump, he recently, it came out that he said that it made perfect sense to him that people would try and kill Mike Pence. And Mike Pence was his, you know, lackey, his public lackey who he got to humiliate for 4 years. But Trump has no loyalty to anybody but Trump. And so it makes perfect sense that all of these people were there for him, making it happen, and then he's not there.
Well, thank you for that call. We have time for one more question. A couple of listeners are actually writing about what we can do, but one listener says, "How do I talk to my Republican family members?" Lisa, any thoughts? We have about a minute left. Lisa, are you still with us?
Well, I think...
Okay, go ahead.
I think we need to ground this in what we are... I am. Can you hear me? Sorry
yes.
about that. I think we need to ground those conversations in where we are united, where we should be united, in defense of our democracy and against anyone who thinks that they should be able to overturn an election by force. That should just be a basic bottom line agreement. Is the devotion to the right to vote versus efforts to make it harder for Americans to vote. So I think we should pursue those common ground values and insist upon them.
Ruth, anything to add?
The research shows that although, and I have several, I have a radicalized parent, the research shows that although we would like to perhaps cast off these people because it's impossible to speak with them and they say repugnant things, the research shows that it's better to try and keep some relation with them, because when they're ready to come out of their bubble of disinformation and their cult, because many of them are in this kind of authoritarian cult dogma, that at least they'll have you will be there to dialogue with them. That's what people who study disinformation and also cults recommend.
Ruth, you have a radicalized parent?
Yeah, my mother she lives in England, and she became radicalized by watching Russia Today, RT, which is Kremlin propaganda, during the lockdowns, during the pandemic.
Wow.
And she went from a conservative person to a far right person. So I'm speaking from personal experience about this.
Wow. We're almost out of time, but what is your relationship like, if you don't mind me asking, and what does she think of your work?
She doesn't want to hear, she's always been very proud of what I've done, but she doesn't want to hear it right now because she is too busy ranting about Biden. And she actually said that Biden isn't doing anything to help Putin. And it's very painful, especially for everyone listening. I'm sure you have friends and family, and especially if you study this stuff. But that's why it is better to try and keep some relationship with them, even if you don't talk about politics, so that when they're ready to come back to the land of truth and logic, they'll have you to talk to.
You know, this might be a really important show to do before the holidays, because I just ran across a book by a woman who said she lost her dad to Fox, and she's just hearing from so many people in a similar situation. So if you're interested, Ruth, we'll be in touch. We'd love to have you back, and we definitely would love to have you talk about your book, Strong Men. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa Graves is Executive Director of True North Research. And Lisa, we'd love to have you back, really, to follow the money. So thank you so much for joining us. Rose Aguilar, it's your call.